This is Jack Reed, recorded at his home in Seaward's End, Saffron Walden in Essex, by Chris Eldon Lee on the 12th of March, 2010. Jack Reed, Part 1.
John Douglas Reed, Andover in Hampshire, 7/10/1926.
So you're now...
83.
83 years old. And the nickname Jack is obvious, is it?
But that arose in the Navy, where I think all Johns are Jacks. And obviously there are a lot of naval blokes with FIDs. But I think possibly my Jack went across because a mate I'd had in the Navy joined FIDs with me. And of course he always called me Jack anyway, so yeah, the name stuck.
Who was that?
Dave Galton. He died 10, 15 years ago, I suppose. But he was just down for the 1 year at the Argentines, the year before I went there.
Right. So what sort of childhood did he have? Was education, normal education?
I was born in Hampshire, as I said. We moved when I was, I don't know, a few years old to Southwick in Sussex, which was a very desirable little place. I think it's changed a hell of a lot now, but in those days, midway between Brighton and Worthing on the coast, it was great. I had a very normal education. I had great hopes, of course, of winning a scholarship and going to Worthing High or Stenning Grammar, but I failed on both of them, so I had to stop and at the normal pre-comprehensive type school that it was, which was a very good one, actually. But it seemed to suit me quite all right, yes.
What was your father's profession?
Father was in the clothing trade. Either he was up to the time, I suppose, we moved to Sussex. Yes, he was clothing shop management. And then after that, after a while anyway, he left that and became an agent where he used to, having a lot of experience with clothing, he used to act as a representative for various manufacturers and wander around, I suppose, flogging the stuff or putting the manufacturer in touch with somebody.
Did Mother have a job?
No. A hobby of which she was very interested in, I think very good too, was playing the piano. And so she did that at local schools and local clubs and all kinds of things, yes. Unfortunately, I never learnt the piano, but there we are, can't be helped.
Thinking back, what would have been your first brush with the Antarctic? When would you first become aware that it existed, shall we say?
I certainly can't remember the first occasion, of course, but I presume it would have been hearing about Captain Scott. a very slight naval connection, of course, between he and I. I had an interest in Antarctica. I mean, it wasn't the be-all and end-all for me by any means because I had other work to do which I enjoyed. But, yes, I had an interest in the polar regions. I didn't know much about them, but I had an interest there.
So you'd read and maybe see the film? John Mills' film?
Oh, that was done a long time after I was down south.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Mm. No, I don't think I've ever seen a film about it at all. But and I'm not even certain I read much about it. I certainly never read expedition books. I wasn't that interested. But I had a general interest in knowing something about it, as I would do about Australia or New Zealand or any other place.
What did you do when you left education?
When I left school.
Mm.
This was in the middle of the war, and so things were a bit up and down. And I joined a small local engineering firm, civil engineering, mainly marine work, which I enjoyed the work very much. Not very big, a few dozen people, a few hundred maybe, I suppose, at the busy time. But what we used to do was, say, stuff with a marine education. Various things come to mind. One of them was converting London River barges into landing craft. We cut the bows off and we put a ramp in it, and then we fitted two large Ford engines in the back end to give propulsion to what was a dumb boat in those days. And we also due to the invasion coming up, we also put in the ramped walkways where the craft could moor, and then the soldiers could go up and down the ramps to climb on board. So, yeah, there was always work of that nature going on. It was quite an interesting job, actually.
Mm. And you ended up in the Navy, didn't you? Was that during the war or afterwards?
Well, my main interest during the war was gliding. I was an NCO in the Air Cadet Corps, and on the strength of that, I volunteered to fly in the Fleet Air Arm. And I went up to London, had an interview, was accepted. Fortunately, that was when I was 16. Obviously, they didn't call me then, but they called me when I was 18. But unfortunately, by that time, they didn't want anybody else. So they gave me the option of, I reported actually to the Butlins holiday camp at Skegness, which was, I forget the name of it, as a naval vessel, but it was named nevertheless. And that's where I arrived. And I was given the option, well, look, since you volunteered to fly, you haven't got any chance of doing it. You can leave the Navy if you like. So I said, well, look, I'll have a go. So I got in touch with the paratroops and the Royal Air Force and anybody else I thought was flying, but there was nothing at all. So I stopped in the Navy to do meteorology, which was near as I could get to air work.
Had you had an interest in the weather beforehand? In meteorology?
No more than average, I don't think. No. I don't think so.
It just came your way, did it?
It just came my way, yeah. Yeah.
And when were you in the Navy right till...
I came out of the Navy... I joined in January 45 and I came out somewhere mid-1947.
Right, so that was when you went from the Navy to FIDS as such?
FIDS, yeah.
What do you remember of the interview? Well, first of all, how did you apply? How did you find out there were jobs going on?
Actually, you've led me on to one of the stories I always love to tell at this particular time.
Please do.
I can remember, actually, when I came out of the Navy and I didn't do much at all, really. I sort of mopped about for a couple of months or something. And I can remember hearing a talk on the radio, no television in those days, talk on the radio by Surgeon Commander Bingham, who, as far as I'm concerned, was one of our leading blokes, polar blokes at the time. And he'd just come back from South with the pre-FIDS organisation, whose name eludes me at the moment.
Operation Tabarin.
Tabarin. Yep, he'd come back from a Tabarin session, and he was coming back to get more people. So I can remember shoving my head through the serving hatch to the kitchen where my mother was working and saying, I like the sound of that, I'll have a go. So she said, up to you. So I did have a go. I stood an advantage, I think, because I was ex-Navy, and he was Navy as well. So up I went, and we had a good interview. It was one of those lovely ones, I think, where it was man to man, he and I. There were no psychiatrists there or personnel managers or anything else to get in the way. It was just the two of us chatting. And he quizzed me about various things and obviously decided he quite liked what he saw. So he sent me off to Harley Street to do a medical. And he also sent me to the Air Ministry to be checked out. So I did both those and came back. And he said, well, they went all right. He said, tell me, he said, another question for you before we sort of come to an answer. If you were sledging and you were limited as to the weight you could carry, what three books would you take bearing inside of that? And I thought, oh, my God, what a terrible question to suddenly throw at somebody. So I said, right, I'd take a book on gliding, which is what interested me at the time. I said, I'd take the Bible, not that I'm particularly religious, but it would seem a good time to read it. And I said, the third book I'd take would be The Four Adventures of Richard Hannay by John Buckham. My God, he said, do you know that's exactly the book I used to take when I went sledging? So I couldn't go wrong after that, could I?
Doesn't sound like it was a particularly rigorous interview.
Oh, he wasn't at all. Oh, no. No, no.
And you don't... Do you think, in retrospect, do you think you were being psyched out to make sure you were suitable mentally to go down to the...
Oh, I think one had to. I really believe... I mean, after all, he was a bloke who'd been doing this for years on and off. And he knew that when you get four blokes, and it was only four blokes stuck together in a hut, they've got to gel as best they can. And so I'm certain he knew precisely what he was looking for. Obviously he made mistakes at times, we all do. But he knew what he was looking for, the type of bloke he thought would gel with other members down south. And was, I was think he that right? was possibly more important than one's technical knowledge.
Yeah. Was he right?
I think he's absolutely right.
Mm.
I think so, yes.
What sort of man was Ted Bingham?
I didn't work with him, unfortunately. I got interviewed by him, and of course I met him at various other times before I went south. Smallish. I think a very pleasant bloke. Surgeon, of course. And by the time he left, he was a surgeon captain. But I think as regards polar knowledge and polar experience, I think he was one of our leading blokes at the time. Without any doubt at all, he'd been doing all kinds of things. No, I had a great deal of time for him, and I think most people did too.
Been there, done it, got the anorak.
Pardon?
Been there, done it, got the anorak.
Yes.
Yeah. So how much of a gap was there between being given the thumbs up and actually sailing?
Oh, not a great deal. We sailed, I was given the thumbs up, I suppose, September or October.
In 48, we're talking.
In 48, yeah. And we sailed beginning of December. So, yeah, it was a month or so.
Yeah.
But which was about the right amount of time, I suppose. I might have had a job which I had to finish. I didn't as it happened. But, yes, it was about the right amount of time, I think, to leave.
Can you remember the reaction back home from the parents?
Well, yeah, not vividly, of course, but obviously to them, their knowledge of Antarctica was no greater than mine. In fact, it may even have been less. And so I suspect they possibly wondered a wee bit what I'd letting myself in for. Mm. But then, of course, the press started to arrive. The local papers heard about it and they came along and wanted to interview me, and I suppose they chatted them parents at all, but no, yes, it all went well, yeah.
So you became a local celebrity for a short time?
Well, yeah, for a short time when I went and for a short time when I came back, yes.
How much training did they give you? Did you have to go on courses to learn what to expect?
No, nothing at all.
Nothing?
Nothing at all. For meteorology, I mean, I wouldn't have expected them to do that. I suppose one could have expected that you might have sat down with somebody and had a chat about what life was generally like down there, how to use clothing and equipment and what to do with dogs and all the rest. But no, you just picked it up as you went along. And obviously we had 2 months on board the ship where you chatted to a number of people who had experience. Slessor was on board with us. He was a doctor in the Falkland Islands then after he'd come back. Bingham didn't come down. Vivian Fuchs, he was our leader, but he hadn't had a great deal of polar, certainly nothing down south. So, no, really it was a matter of experiencing things and learning as you went.
What was the trip south like? This was
The old John Biscoe.
Yeah.
The old wooden one.
Just acquired it, hadn't they, I think? Is that right?
Yeah, they had. Yeah, it was that year, it was still in its naval form. We slept in we slept in the front hold, as it happened, with bunks, which were just sort of put up for us. But and it was all, yes, it was very crude and rough, but they'd only just acquired the Biscoe quite rapidly from the Yankee Navy. And it went well, I think. Yeah, well, we didn't expect too much else anyway.
Some people are surprised at how small she was.
Yeah, all right, small. I'm trying to think what I think about 12,000 tonnes, if I remember correctly. Okay, small, but efficient. Made of wood, which, of course, was the most important thing there. But, yeah, when she came back the second year, she'd been rebuilt inside. And my impression was she was a much nicer thing to travel in. She was a bit more like a liner or a properly equipped ship than she was when she went down.
So in the year that you went, just describe then the facilities available to you on board the ship.
Well, we certainly didn't have cabins. As I say, we had the hold where we had about 15 bunks, I would have thought, which had been put in there. So we lived down there. We had a dining room up top, which was one of the rooms alongside the mess, alongside the wardroom, rather. But apart from that, I don't think we had anything else at all.
What were the heads like?
Presumably the old original heads would have sort of been, they could have coped with three or four blokes and that was all. I wouldn't have think it'd been much more than that. Certainly no showers, and I would have thought no baths. I can't remember any, anyway.
And there were quite a few of you on board, weren't there?
I would have thought there were about 25 or 6 expedition people, yes, because we were going down to fill 6 or 7 bases at 4 blokes a time, or on average 4 or 5. Yeah, there were 20-odd of us going down, yes.
Apart from Dr. Slessor, Vivian Fuchs was on board.
Yep.
Did you get a chance to get to know him?
Fuchs?
Hmm.
Well, to a certain extent, yes. Mark, you, I mean, there were 24 or 5 of us, so he wanted to get to know us all in time because he was the governor of the expedition, the senior bloke there. But when you've got that number of people concentrating on one man, there's not a great deal of, you don't get a great deal of time to sort of get to know him all that well. But he seemed a very nice bloke anyway.
And Dick Laws, did you get to know him?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Dick came down as just a plain common or garden geologist when we went there. And he was dropped off, of course, at Cygni. And he went ashore with 2 other, but there were only 3 of them when the year he was there.
And the first mate was Lord Headley.
That's right, number one, an Irish chappie. Yeah, he was nice, nice bloke.
He had a nickname, apparently. No?
Doesn't ring a bell, no.
Okay.
What was it?
I don't know, I'm asking you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. No. He was just number one as far as we were concerned.
Yeah, yeah.
The skipper was a chappie who'd been the commander of the of the old Discovery investigation ship, Discovery. I'm under the impression he drunk a bit, actually, and I've got a feeling that's how he lost the command eventually.
Right.
But I might be wrong, but I think that's the case.
In your kit bag, you took a film camera, Jack, because I saw the film just the other night.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Yep, I took a 16mm big old thing, which I took down, yes, which I used a lot. I used as much as I could. I couldn't afford film to any large extent. In fact, I couldn't afford colour at all. It was all black and white, but I think it was actually Dick Laws who gave me a spool of coloured film. So, yeah, there was a bit of colour to illustrate what it really looks like down there.
And were you a keen cameraman beforehand? You'd never.
I was keen to the extent that at one time I wanted to join the BBC or the film profession as a cameraman, yes. It didn't turn out. But, yes, from that point of view, I was interested, yes.
Mm. And were you given any guidance whilst you were down there by anybody else on using the camera?
No. I don't.
A chap called Bob Moss?
Oh, I'm sorry, you're quite right. Bob was with us, yes. He, of course, he was the cameraman on board the Scott film. He went south doing that. Yes, I must have learnt something from him, of course. Yes, I must have done. Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry, I've forgotten about Bob, yes. Yeah.
Was it fun to be filming?
Bob?
No, was it fun?
Oh, to be for me?
Hmm.
I don't know about fun. No, it was interesting. Because you're always looking for the right light and the right position for you to stand without falling into the ice, and for the other blokes to do the right thing at the right time. So, yes, it was interesting. I wouldn't say fun.
No, okay. And you were filming. Most of the film seems to be concerned with a transfer, doesn't it, from one base to the other. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, when we were going round, I mean, we did a lot at... I did a lot, rather. I can remember at Cygni, when we were bringing the blokes... putting the blokes ashore, Dick Laws and his crowd. And, of course, we had... to every bloke who goes, there must be 40 tonnes, I suppose, of spares, 40 tonnes of spares and food and all the rest of it, which accompanies each bloke in time. So, there's an awful lot of work to do at a base when you're setting one up. and restaffing it.
Watching the film of unloading supplies, I think that was at Signy, in fact, on the first port of call.
Yeah.
It did look a bit haphazard. It didn't look as though it was particularly safe.
I would have thought that was fair comment. I mean, after all, we only had, I suppose, two boats in order to bring the stuff ashore. It was loaded. The boats were loaded off the Biscoe by crewmen there, so they did the right thing. I don't say they took everything off in the right position, but they took it off as it was in the holds. And then, in turn, when it came ashore, that was always unloaded by expedition blokes. So most of them, like me, had never had experience of doing it before, so we just sort of grabbed whatever we could and made our way up to the base hut as best we could.
And I guess you're in a fairly tight time frame to do all this, weren't you, really?
Oh, yes. I suppose we were limited to 2 or 3 days, I would think, to take the old blokes off of base and put the new blokes in, plus all their year's supplies.
So tell me about your first season at Admiralty Bay, then. What sort of... Your main job was to rebuild the hut, is that correct?
No, to build it.
To build it?
There was nothing there at all.
So they offloaded you with tents and so on to live in?
No. In that case, what we did, we built it with the aid of the other expedition members and the ship's crew who could be spared on the Biscoe. She sat in the harbour at Admiralty Bay and helped us. And I suppose we took, I don't know, a week or 10 days to put the hut up and to get it basically assembled and basically livable. And then we were then left with what we had to do to finish the hut off and with all our supplies. So, yeah, I suppose it took 10 or 14 days, I suppose, to sort of get the hut as ready as we could when we were left in it, five of us.
Was there any discussion about where exactly the hut should be, or was that all predetermined?
No, that point came up at the time. That's one of the jobs that Fuchs would have done. Possibly with Slessor, I suppose. But, I mean, the rest of us hadn't got enough experience to sort of offer much guidance. We might sort of offer guidance from saying, my Christ, you expect us to walk from the sort of the sea up to that height. But, no, it was all reasonably straightforward.
We're talking about just after the war, aren't we, 1948, yes. I guess, by this time. Turned 1948. So how primitive was the hut? Were there any improvements, would you say, over Scott's day, or was it still...
I wouldn't have thought it was a great deal over it. All right, the windows were double glazed, I expect. I can't remember, but I feel certain they were. And the hut was nicely lined, but it wasn't very big. And it was pretty bare inside. There was nothing sort of desperate about it. We didn't have a lounge or anything else. We had a sitting and a dining area, but there was nothing flashy about it at all.
And there were going to be four of you, is that right?
There were five.
Five.
We finished up with four, I'm afraid. Yeah.
Yes. Well, let's talk. You're talking about Eric Platt, I
guess,
aren't you?
Yeah.
Will you talk about that for a couple of minutes?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Eric was the base leader, a geologist, and he was very good at whatever he turned his hand to. Very good with tools. Yeah, a very handy bloke. Anyway. Coming on to the first spring we were there, we thought we ought to have some penguin eggs. Now, we hadn't got a rookery anywhere near us, but Admiralty Bay, if you've got a large lump of land here, Admiralty Bay is here, and we were on that side, and we knew on the outside there, against the sea, there was a rookery. So we were going to go across here. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been trying to think, and I can't think whether we rode across here or skied across here. I just can't remember. Anyway, we got there. And then there, Eric and I climbed up a steep run between glaciers, crossed over the top, and had a much steeper run down towards the sea, and there was the rookery, sure.
Was this man-hauling?
Pardon?
Were you man-hauling?
Man-hauling, yeah. We had skis once we were... On the other side of the harbour to get us up over on the breast and then crest and then drop down to the sea. So we got down there and loaded our bags up with a few dozens of eggs, of course. Eric, being the keen bod that he was, He's shot off up the very steep slope on the seaside, and I was still sort of dawdling, following him up, stopping every 50 feet, I suppose, and having a pant. Got up there and found he was a bit knackered. So we had a word about it and sort of decided we'd move on. So by this time we'd reached the top of the brow, ready to start dropping back down to the harbour again. And we hadn't gone too far when he said, look, I can't go any further. So I said, well, dump your eggs and I'll give you a hand and we'll go as far as we can. And we got a bit further on and eventually said, I can't do it anymore, I'm knackered. So I said, well, look, stop there, but for God's sake, don't sit still and idle because it's too damn cold for that. Try and keep on the move if you can. And by this time, I was going to drop down and hopefully I could have got in touch with the base. We hadn't got any radios or anything. I would have hoped that I could have waved to the base. It was about a mile on the other side of the harbour. Or that for some reason they might have come, as it happened. By the time I got down to the bay, three of the blokes had landed. They were obviously a bit worried the fact that we were taking such a long time. And I said, oh, thank God you're here. Quick, we've got to go back up. I've left Eric on top. He's not at all well. So the three of us started the climb up, and eventually I could see Eric as a dark mark on the brow of the hill before you drop back down to the sea. God, we got on as best we could, and unfortunately, one of the blokes fell down a crevasse on our way up there. I forget who that was. Dennis Farmer, was it? Doesn't matter, I can't remember. Anyway, we got him out, went up the hill, and of course by that time I'm afraid Eric was dead. So we brought Eric and the eggs back for what that's worth, came back down to the shore, and then crossed over again. So I can't remember whether ice or not, either by boat or by ski and sledge. And we left Eric outside the hut in the cold, where of course he'd be conserved as best as possible for what that was worth. And got in touch with Fuchs, and he then instructed the Biscoe to come back, where the captain of the Biscoe, plus one or two other people, held an inquiry into it, where I was called in and sort of, I repeated just about the same story to them as I've said to you. And I was asked if I could think of any reasons why, and I said, well, I said he was a terribly enthusiastic bloke and went in like a bomb out of a what have you, every time to tackle something. But I said that there was one other point which I think might be of note. Obviously, being comrades for a year, we chatted to ourselves and we all learnt history about the others for various other reasons. And I said there were two points which Eric came up with which I think have a note. He didn't go in the service, although he should have been, because he was the same age as the rest of us. And that was because he was turned down by the service, military service medical people, on the basis he had an enlarged heart, slightly off centre. So I said, what that means, I really don't know, but it might be one of the reasons why his heart packed up, or whatever it was, on this particular occasion.
Just go back to Eric describing to you, saying he couldn't go on. Did he explain why he couldn't go on? What did he say? How was he at that point?
Well, he would have said he couldn't go on, but I mean, he wouldn't have said that with any degree of logic. He would have said it from the point of view, oh my God, I'm knackered. There's something wrong. I can't go on. He was obviously aware that there was something wrong, and I was equally aware. And by this time, I was trying to hold him, but I just couldn't do it. He was just too much and too unstable. So, yes, he degenerated from where we came up from the sea to the top before we started to go back down again towards the harbour bay. I mean, it took 3/4 of an hour, I suppose, and say 1/2 mile when he got progressively worse and worse until eventually he couldn't move at all at the end.
What happened to the body? Was it taken on the ship?
No, he was buried near the site. We had a little hillock which we decided we rather liked, and we laid the and they laid the coffin. I can't remember, honestly, what we put him in. Anyway, he was buried on this little hillock and covered in stones, which I hope is still there.
So there was no autopsy, no medical examination?
No. They presumably, that was the skipper of the Biscoe and whoever else was on the committee with him. Presumably they accepted it, and they must have also discussed it with Bunny Fuchs, and he presumably accepted it as well.
Looking back now on that incident, is it surprising to you that the FIDS should recruit somebody with a heart condition? Or were the medical so informal?
Well, all right, there's another point there then of interest. I think I went to Harley Street. Now, presumably they sent me to somebody in Harley Street who knew what he was doing and who particularly was picked for his ability to check a bloke over medically for the job that was coming up. Eric, on the other hand, if I remember correctly, he went to the School of Tropical Hygiene in Liverpool because that happened to be nearer to where he was living than Harley Street was to where I was living. Now, if you're going to send a bloke to the School of Tropical Hygiene, I wouldn't have thought there were too many people there knew what you were going to do when you went south and how to check you out physically for it anyway.
How old was he when he passed away?
Well, I would have been 21 and he was 21, 22. I wouldn't say any more.
Can you remember the impact his death had upon the rest of you back at the base?
Well, yes, of course, because when you've lived with a bloke for, in this case, 7 or 8 months, I suppose, when five of you have lived together as a group and you've worked together, you've all got your own little jobs, and to take one of you away sort of upsets the whole system. I'm not saying that I was being annoyed at Eric for doing that, but that was a fact. The whole system was upset, and so from that point of view, and the fact that the poor blighter had died as well, yes, it was a shock. But we were young, and we had to get on with it, and as best we could, we did.
So, what was the recovery time like before spirits were somewhat restored? Was there always a cloud?
I don't say there was always a cloud, because although obviously there were times when you suddenly say, well, we did that. Oh, I did that with Eric. And you thought, oh, God. That sort of thing. So, but, of course, again, it was November, I think, when he died, and we were due for the ship to come in, presumably about January. So I would have thought that the real effect had very largely worked off after a month. You never forget a thing like that, of course, no. Naturally. But being young down there and having to work to keep yourself going, you really have to get round it somehow or other.
Who took over as base leader? Or did he not just do that?
Yes, I think it was one of the Falkland Islanders, actually. Because he'd had experience down there before. He'd been down the year before we went, putting up a temporary shed at Admiralty Bay, which we in turn then used for stores. I ought to know his name. Ian Biggs was one of the Falkland Islanders. And the other one, no, can't remember, I'm afraid.
Don't worry about it. We can look it up later on.
Yeah, that's fine.
Just looking through I've got some of the base documents from base G for that year.
Have you?
Which have been sent from archives. There's one or two nice little things here that I understand you were surprised to find some fossilised plants in the area. Is that right? Remember that?
No, I don't remember that, no.
Okay.
But Eric would have done that as part of his geology.
So I presume I'm reading Eric's report here.
Ah. No, I don't remember that, I'm afraid, no. What date was that report, by the way?
Well, it covers a period December 48 to November 49. And it wasn't written by Eric Platt because it says here that Eric Platt died on duty 10th of November 1948, yeah. aged 22 years. All right.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. But it also suggests that you were only actually at the base for a short period of time, which seems a bit odd.
I was there for the whole year.
Mm, yeah. So what sort of things, what sort of duties, apart from the meteorology, how far out and about did you get? Did you get on many sledging trips from...
No, we didn't have a sledge. We had no gear at all.
Nothing at all at Apple?
No. It was quite a hilly place, was King George Island, and we used to fiddle about on skis and try to run as best we could, but we certainly had no sledging equipment. I had my weather reports, 4 a day, I suppose I did, of which we transmitted twice. But, of course, apart from that, one of you's cook of the day for a week.
Mm-hmm.
One of you brings the food in and also brings ice in to melt down for water. You've got no dogs to look after there, as it happened either, but that's another big-time job if you've got dogs. But there's always sort of work which you fit into and which also fits into a pattern which you have to build up as a group.
Did you find the work interesting, because the meteorological work? Or was it?
Some of it was. I mean, it was mainly routine. I'd been doing it in the Navy and then I just carried on with FIDS. So it was very largely routine. But obviously there were things that cropped up. And I can't think what they were at the moment. But there must have been things that cropped up which I thought, my God, I've never met that one before. Or why did that happen? Et cetera, et cetera.
Having built the hut, did it take quite a long time to kind of develop it into a proper full-blown base? Were you still working on it throughout the whole season?
No. To put the hut up, I said, was a month, which I suppose is a round figure to work on. After that, we had lots of fiddlings about to do. I mean, the inside fittings had to be done because we'd been concentrating on doing the basic shell. So it took a bit of time, but it wouldn't have taken over much because, after all, you're going down there. You haven't got too much gear with you because you just haven't got room to bring it in or get it ashore or even use it. So, no, it was all very basic, really.
Mm. What was the communications like in those in your first season?
We had Dennis Farmer, who was a radio operator. He'd been in the Merchant Navy. Twice a day, he would contact the main base, Marguerite Bay, with my Met reports. And then, I suppose, I think that was the only routine stuff. We had no other routine stuff. We used to like to listen to the Falkland Island radio, mm-hmm. because that was one of the only sort of natural civilian-type radios we could come across. And, of course, if anything came up, if you got an illness and you wanted advice from the doctor, that would have been the quack down at Marguerite Bay, you could have chatted with him over the radio and sort of worked out what you could. But there was nothing desperate about it at all.
Were you very much left to your own devices, or was there still a certain amount of control coming from the Falklands? Miles Clifford, I think, was the governor at the time, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
Were you aware of his shadow, if you like?
No, I don't think so. I mean, he came down once or twice on the John Biscoe. And he was a decent bloke, I think. But I would have thought that once you were at a base, no, you're very largely on your own. All right, if things went wrong, you got hold of the radio quickly and asked for help. In many cases, of course, you couldn't get it because the nearest base was 500 or 1,000 miles away. But No, we weren't over controlled at all by any means. No.
Was there a sense of excitement about the whole thing? You'd obviously gone down to the Antarctic with a optimism and excitement about what you were going to be doing down there. Did it live up to expectations?
I think so. And I think with me, particularly dealing with weather, it would have been the weather which would have excited me, because it was so totally different from anything I'd met before. It was always interesting, actually, to find that had we got the right boots, had we been issued with the right boots, sometimes they were right, sometimes they were completely wrong. Had we been issued with the right sheath knife, the first year we had super sheath knives. The second year they gave us a sheath knife which was about as much use as that blooming table when it came to sort of operating outside and using a knife to carry out your work. So, what was the original question?
Well, the whole Antarctic experience lived up to your expectations.
Oh, I see. Oh, I think so, yes. Yes, I think it did, by all means. Mm. Obviously, life at our base without any sledging was a lot quieter than if you were at a base with dogs and sledging, as I discovered, of course, in the second year.
Mm. Well, let's move on to your second year then, shall we? Because I'll perhaps come back to Base G later on. But what I find interesting is did you actually choose to go to Base F for the second year?
No, there was talk at one time of opening up another base, and I was told by Bunny Fuchs, I suppose, that I might be going to this other base as base leader. I forget which base it was, but it wasn't opened up. So it was then decided. They usually used to try and move the blokes around from base to base. So it was then decided, I suppose, by somebody that I would go around to
Argentine.
The Argentines, yeah.
Yeah. And you had no choice? Were you happy to go?
Oh, quite happy. Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, I knew nothing about it at all, except what I'd read in Bingham's book, the base leader's book on the activities of the British Groenland Expedition, where they were forced to stay at the Argentine Islands for a year because they couldn't get the ship in. So one knew a bit about it from that, but yeah, no, it was looked upon as a, and I knew there were dogs there as well, which again was going to be a point of interest. Mm.
Did you go straight from one to the other, or did you go back to Falklands in between?
At one time I went to the Falklands because I had something wrong with a tooth. And on one of the excursions between the islands and the Falklands, they took me back and took me to the doctor, the local doctor, the local dentist in the Falklands, and he pulled a tooth out. Yeah. Yeah.
So tell me about arriving at Argentine Island. Was it very different from Admiralty?
No, they're all bases are very similar, really. You've obviously got to approach all of them by sea, so that means they've all got to be in the same position, they've all got to be accessible from the beach. In this case, the Argentine Islands is a much smaller bay. I can't think what the name of the bay is, but it's far smaller than where the ship went in to get to the base. But like most of them, having got ashore, you've then got a 50-yard run up the beach to get to the hut.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, there's not a great deal of difference between any of them, really. The size of the hut is different, the shape of the hut is different, but otherwise, no, not a great deal of difference.
So the big difference was the activities. I mean, were you still Metman officially?
I still went across there as Metman, yeah. There were four of us there, so I went as Metman. And I had the number two team, and Jumbo Nickel, who was stopping on as the leader for the second year, he had the number one team. And so he and I used to do all the sledging, and either just he and I together, or we did about five trips, I think it was, or we'd have on one trip all of us went out, but that wasn't a very good idea, I don't think. And eventually they finished up with just he and I would do the sledging, and the other two blokes would stop behind in the hut.
I'll come to the sledging in just a moment, but there's a lovely note here that somebody wrote a report on the meteorological instruments at base F-14950, which may well have been you. And you talked about the hydrogen generator and the cylinders. You weren't able to do any balloon ascents. Is this you again? It was impossible to do any balloon ascents during the course of the year. The only chemical hell for the generator was ferrosilicon, and the protective caps for the hydrogen cylinders could never be removed. It is suggested that these caps be loosened before the cylinders are sent down south, as once arriving with tight caps, little can be done to them. Does that ring any bells?
That doesn't ring a bell, but I can well imagine it took place, yes. Mm. And that presumably would have been written by me if it was concerning 49. Well, it was
base F in 49/50.
I don't remember it physically taking place like that, but yeah, I can well imagine it nevertheless.
An inventory of all the equipment, including the anemometers and the height of them and so on.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, let's look at some of the sledging then. Tell me about your first big trip. Well, first of all, you had to train them.
Now, the dogs were trained.
They were already pre-trained. Yeah.
The Argentines was kept not as a main sledging base because an awful lot of work had been done up and down it by the British Groundland Expedition. And the FIDs, when they got there, they wanted to have different bases to explore different land. The main two bases, of course, in Hope Bay, which was north of us, and Marguerite Bay, which was at the bottom of the Groenland Peninsula. They were the two main bases, and we were kept rarely as a base to look after the dogs, maintain them, train them, and keep them ready for any other use that may arise.
And you had your own personal team?
Yep. Yep, had a team of seven dogs.
Yes. Led by who?
They were initially led by Rebecca. But I wasn't too happy with her, actually, so I changed it to somebody. Who the devil was the other bloke? Do you want me to get my book and look at it?
Was it Whitey?
Pardon?
Whitey?
No.
What was the problem with Rebecca? Because there's a lovely film of her.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't remember at the time, but I can't remember now, I must admit. But I was a bit unhappy with Rebecca. I can't think of the reason for it, no.
Okay. Yeah.
But anyway, I moved one of the other dogs up and she came back and she ran in the team.
How did you take to working with dogs? Because, again, I guess you'd had no training as such.
Oh, nothing at all. Jumbo, of course, had had a year at it and he'd had to pick it all up as he went. No, it was very largely a case of you get a feeling for animals, which I had, and you also get a feeling for dogs and doing the work. And if you learn the routines always vary with individuals. The way you drive the team, the way you talk to the team, all the rest of it, they all vary between individuals. But no, you very, very quickly pick up the routine.
So tell me about your this first significant trip then.
The first trip we did was, again, due to lack of experience, pure or much experience, we decided to go over midwinter because we decided that that would be the time when the ice would be at its thickest and we used to have less chance of falling through it. So we loaded up the sledges. We had them outside the base hut. And then up early the next day, when of course it didn't get light until about 10 o'clock in the morning, I suppose, and got dark at about 3 in the afternoon in that case. But we wanted to go somewhere down south. I can't quite think of the reason, I must admit. But anyway, in this case, we were taking the loaded sledges down to dump them and make a depot. So we had two of us on each of the sledges and we just worked as best we could, yeah.
Was this to Garcia? Does that ring a bell?
Gosh, you're certainly one of the places. I can't remember on this occasion where we were going, no.
Okay. And that was, because it was midwinter, it was actually quite hard work, was it?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, as I say, all our work was over sea ice. There was no land. Well, it was land when we got there because we could climb up and do that. But we sledged over the sea ice. We camped on the sea ice. And since it was our first trip, we decided, as I've said, that possibly the ice was at its thickest at that stage and that's the best time to go. And we went, I don't know, 14 or 15, 16 days, I suppose, the first trip. Again, I could look it up in my diary, but I can't tell you offhand. But it was enough to keep us going anyway. And so we, having arrived at our particular spot, we picked an island, no doubt, I can't remember which, and we left most of the stores there as a depot so that in future we could go back down there without having to carry too much and have a depot of supplies left there ready for our future use.
Were the dogs amenable all the time, or did they have a mind of their own?
No, they were remarkably friendly to the human. They aren't always friendly amongst themselves. But I am now and always have been a cat lover. I don't have much to do with dogs here. That's the only big time in my life of dealing with dogs. And they were working dogs, not pets. But I think if you've got that sort of feeling for animals, be they dogs or anything else, I think it all fits in rather well. I like them all. But say they scrap between themselves at times, given half a chance. And if you fed them wrongly, I mean, when you're out sledging, you pin that you've got the trace end, of course, fits on the tent on the sledge, and the other end we put a spike in the ground, so that gave you three pairs of dogs plus a single one at the end
on spans. Yeah.
Pardon?
On spans.
Yeah, on spans. And then of course you've got to do that. You've got to feed them by chucking the food as far out as you can, so that the mate on the other side can't get to the food. And as long as you did that, it's okay. But some of them were greedy enough; they'd eat quickly and they'd try and pinch their mate's grub. But I suppose that's to be expected amongst animals of any sort, isn't it?
Yeah.
But otherwise, no. I mean, no, they all work very well.
When you were camping on sea ice, was that because you had no choice? Because it was later discovered that, well, later in FID's history, camping on sea ice was really frowned upon, wasn't it?
Well, I suppose it might be from the point of view of the possible danger, but... Yeah. We never came across any problems at all. We came across a problem at one time, I can remember, and this was possibly our fault. We were cutting around the side of an iceberg, and presumably, and I can't think who it was, but one of the blokes sort of went up to his waist in water. The team didn't, luckily, but he managed to hold on and he got pulled out. But yes, all right, in that particular case, the iceberg presumably had been moving backwards and forwards, broken the ice, and it then froze, but nowhere near as solidly as the rest of the stuff was that we were working on.
I think travelling by sea ice was recognised all the way through as being the best way of travelling. But the whole concept of camping and sleeping on sea ice, you didn't have any worries about that in your era?
No, we didn't.
There's a note here about when the Biscoe arrived at the Argentine Islands the first time. This would be February 50, I guess. They'd actually got to the point where they were very low on food for the dogs at all, and they were killing skewers to feed the dogs. Does that ring any bells?
No, that wasn't. That certainly wasn't us. That must have been. That could have been beginning of 50.
Yeah,
it could be. I mean, I don't know why, because we had one of our jobs, of course, when we had these 15 dogs to look after, plus any pups that arrived, we had to kill as many seals as we thought were required, and we used to kill them and leave them on a small island, which, of course, didn't sort of cut it off when there was ice there, but when there was water there, you've got this little island, and we used to have to take a boat out and get hold of a seal and tow it back again before we broke it up for the dogs. You'd cut it up for the dogs. So we never had any problems, but I can imagine that they might have done in 50, but I hadn't heard of that one, no.
So you'd never kill the skewer to feed to dogs?
No.
I was trying to work out how it could be done, because...
I quite agree. I don't know how you do it. I mean, I suppose you'd have to... Well, I was going to say shoot it, but then...
Or net
you
it.
Can hardly feed a skewer full of shot, can you, to anything? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how you do it, actually. Because they're a very active bird as a skewer. No, I don't know. No, I wouldn't like to do that at all.
You had your own team, as you mentioned.
Yes.
How did that happen? Because you had no experience of dogs, so was it just a case that you chose or volunteered to run your own team and the other chaps didn't?
Well, as I said, Jumbo was there for his second year. He'd had 1 year, and presumably he saw me as being possibly the best choice to run the second team. And he asked me, I suppose, I can't remember, and he asked me if I wanted to, and obviously I said yes. So, I mean, that's the way it accepted. I was accepted as being the driver of the second team, yes. Mm. The teams, for what they're worth, he was number one, which was a long-legged team, generally long-legged, because they can get through the snow much more easily than the short dog, a short-legged dog. And I was the number two team with heavier set and shorter-legged dogs. With a heavier load, so my team had a pull more than his.
So there was tactics, was there? The long-legged dogs blazed the trail. That's right. And the short-legged dogs followed on.
That's right, pulling.
I've not come across that before.
Oh, you hadn't?
Okay, no.
Oh yes, that's the way we worked it anyway.
And there were some pups arrived as well at some point.
Yeah, we had. I can only think of two pups we had actually. That must have been. They must have been Rebecca's pups, I suppose.
Mm.
And we got into a terrible fix at one time. I don't know whether it was Rebecca or not. We were out sledging and she gave birth to them. Luckily, we were only about a day from home, but...
Could this have been Whitey, in fact?
Whitey was the other team, actually. It wasn't my bitch, I don't think. Right. Again, I could look it up, but I can't remember offhand. Whitey, I think, was Jumbo's bitch. It was my bitch. That must have been Rebecca, who had two pups when we were out sledging. We thought originally we could get back to base before she did it, but she beat us to it and had the pups. So we had to carry the pups on the sledge, wrapped up as best we could, and she was in there and in the team. And then we'd stop every hour or so. We'd take the pups out and give it to her, and she'd feed them and. We'd repeat again, and we eventually got home like that. No problem at all.
There's a reference in one of the base reports where I think Whitey also gave birth, and the person writing the report had to decide whether to knock the pups on the head there and then.
That's right.
Or to decide to take.
Well,
them back.
I must be wrong then. That must be Whitey, because I can remember us discussing this. Yes, as to whether we should bother to take the pups or not.
What was the decision about, really? Why would there be a debate?
Because of the hassle that's involved in trying to run a dog and a team and also bring the pups along as well. But we decided we'd give it a go, and it wasn't many days when we were away from base, so we did it, and it worked out quite happily, yeah.
Were you fond of the pups when they arrived?
Oh, yeah, they were lovely, yeah. Oh, yes, beautiful things.
Yes. And they were given names. Dark Danko? Where are we? Of course, I can't find that immediate reference right now, but still.
No, I can't remember them, but their name, I'm afraid, no.
No, okay. I'm just picking through the reports here, but there was an injury when you were out sledging to Farmer.
Dennis Farmer?
Yeah. He got dragged and hit his side against a piece of ice and hurt his kidneys. You were running a team one morning with the dogs, and the dogs bolted.
Yeah, could be. I must admit, I don't remember that.
No, okay.
I think I can remember Dennis being in bed, yes, and that's one of the occasions we'd had to rung up the doctor at Marguerite Bay and ask for his advice. But I must admit, I'd forgotten how the occasion arose.
All right.
But that must have been it, as you say.
Should we take a break there,
yeah,
Jack,
sure.
And come back and do some more shortly?
Yeah.
Well, then, thank you.
You'd like a tea?
I'd love one, yes.
Yeah, right, yes. Okay, yes.